This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. I am C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I'm speaking with Aliesta Salnikova-Gilmore about her debut novel, The Witch and the Tsar. Strictly speaking, The Witch and the Tsar is historical fantasy rather than historical fiction. I am conducting the interview because the novel is set during the reign of Ivan the Terrible, the source of both my fiction and my nonfiction. It seemed too good an opportunity to pass up. In the excerpt that follows, the Eye is Yaga, better known as Baba Yaga, the wicked witch of Russian folklore. But as we soon discover, Yaga in this novel is quite different from the hook-nosed crone who rides the skies in her mortal and pestle, luring children to their doom. Late May, 1560. When my owl landed on my shoulder, I knew heartbreak was not far behind. It was not the twilight tasted different, though on my tongue the humid spring air had the bitterness of snowfall. It was that even this deep in the Russian forest, dusk bled into the light with infuriating leisure. The clouds had smothered the last of the sun's rays in scarlet. Yet day clung on, delaying what mortals intended to find their way to my izbushka. The log hut stood on chicken legs, not swaying or spinning or even pacing, as unnaturally still as me. I usually fidgeted with impatience, eager for my first client to appear, for my work to begin. Now unease wrapped around my throat, silent as a viper. My owl could only be here to deliver bad tidings. Like her namesake, Night, Notch came in the company of darkness and shadows. It was then the mortals arrived with their fevers, skin infections, and stomach poisons, with the burns from the fires that spread too quickly in their cramped wooden villages. They did not approach me in the light of day, even if it was waning, not unless they brought disaster. Norch's bright yellow gaze fixed on me pointedly. She let out a screech loud enough to reanimate the skulls on the fence encircling my izbushka. "They are here, ya." Her voice and the language she spoke reverberated through my mind, becoming words I could understand. "Already?" I asked in Russian. Someone was coming. Someone desperate enough to risk being seen. "Who is it?" And now, please join me in welcoming Aliesta Salnikova-Gilmore. Hi, Aliesta. I look forward to talking with you today.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
The Witch and the Tsar is your first published novel. How did you get into writing fiction?
Well, at the time I started to write seriously, I was working as a lawyer at a large law firm in Chicago, and I had started to feel that it wasn't quite the right fit, which is a very difficult position to be in, especially after all that schooling and work that I had to do. But I always dreamed of writing a novel. I loved books ever since my grandfather would read to me as a little girl. I was a voracious reader, just like many authors. And I actually started my first book, not The Witch and the Tsar, right out of college, but just never got around to finishing it. I probably just didn't know how to finish it. And so my husband was actually the one who encouraged me many years later when I was a lawyer to finish that book and see how I liked writing. And it turned out I liked it very much as I kept on writing.
Ah, that's a great story. Now, you were born and spent your early years in Moscow. Is it fair to assume you were exposed to Baba Yaga as a child?
Yeah, absolutely. Baba Yaga was a major presence in my childhood. In fact, my mother would oftentimes evoke her name every time I misbehaved, which was a lot, especially at night because I never wanted to go to bed. And so she would tell me, you know, if you don't go to bed, Bobby Gaz is going to sneak into your room through the balcony window, take you, you know, in her mortar and take you to her chicken legged hut in the woods. And I'm never going to see you again. That's how my mom would tell me. And so I really grew up with kind of the specter of her, always a little frightening, but also very fascinating to me.
I have to admit, she terrified me as a child. I remember reading a book of Russian fairy tales. I was probably about 8 or 9, and I just thought it was way too much.
Yes, I know. Well, like all fairy tales, you know, we read not only the Slavic fairy tales, Grimm fairy tales, and Andersen fairy tales. They're quite gruesome, actually.
They are, yeah. The original Grimm fairy tales are very gruesome as well. So what made you decide that Yaga needed a makeover?
I like how you put that, makeover. You know, I wasn't really interested in writing about the fearsome hag that we all know from the fairy tales. Just because she's already in the fairy tales, and she's a bit of a figure of ridicule, and definitely affects his contempt, and she's a bit of a caricature and joke, especially if you look at some of the Soviet movies that she makes an appearance in throughout the 20th century. And so when I started my research, I very much wanted to do a different interpretation of her. What really helped me was the fact that some scholars do believe that the Baba Yaga we know is actually based on a fertility and earth goddess or her descendant that was worshipped by ancient pagan Slavs a very long time ago. And I instantly became interested in that particular concept. How does a goddess get turned into a witch? And an old ugly word at that. And I really wanted to reframe the story of Baba Yaga, imagining, because it is a reimagining of what she could have been like if she was a goddess and also a human woman, both, before rumor had reduced her to the silly old crone we all know and love.
So Yun Yaga has lived for centuries by the time this novel opens. We'll talk about her past a bit later, but why, out of the many options available, did you decide to center this story on the second half of Ivan the Terrible's reign?
Well, I've always been fascinated with the medieval era in general. And looking at the medieval era, Ivan came rather naturally. He was the first czar. He is, even to this day, a very popular czar, and he is known for to have a little bit of a temper, obviously, as his the terrible part of his name shows. And I had picked him before I found out a lot more about him, and my research made him an even more perfect opponent for Yaga. Well, first I found out he was incredibly paranoid and controlling. Most fun for me, he was superstitious. He believed in witchcraft. He believed in witches. He believed in spells. He would often invite fortune tellers and sorcerers and other such people to his court. And so I just thought, you know, I could definitely see him inviting someone like Yaga to his court. And I could see him being so incredibly livid and also threatened by someone like Yaga, a powerful woman who, you know, comes to court and then challenges him.
Describe your Yaga for us at the moment we meet her.
Well, in the beginning of the book, she is living alone in the woods with her pet, her wolf Dane, which means day. And her owl, Mulich, which means night. So, of course, they're based on, for anyone who knows the Baba Yaga mythology, they're based on the night that Baba Yaga has, you know, day, night, and early morning. So I kind of just did day and night. So Yaga is a healer. She's a witch. She helps and advises whoever dares to come to her hut deep in the woods. And she is fiercely independent, but she's also lonely as well. She misses being around people. She's half human, so naturally that side of her definitely, you know, calls to her. And she misses being around people, though she really hates to admit that.
One of the fun parts of the story for me, maybe it's my revenge on that 9-year-old self who was terrified, was seeing the way that you twist some of the tropes associated with the fairy tale, Baba Yaga. So tell us a little bit about Little Hen. You've already mentioned Nortje and Dien.
Little Hen, actually, you may be surprised to know that Little Hen was actually a late addition to the book. I was working on my edits with my editor, and we were trying to enhance some of the more fantastical elements. And I was trying to get at some of the more traditional elements from the Baba Yaga myth. As a background, initially, I was more focused on the historical elements and making Yaga a strong, powerful, and relatable heroine in her own right. And when I was working on the fantasy, I thought to myself, why don't I have a chicken-legged hut? I mean, this is Baba Yaga, after all. And after I had the idea for Little Hen, I wanted to make her character in her own right. You know, she's sort of this just hut on chicken legs from the fairy tale. But I wanted to give her a little bit of her own personality, make her, you know, have a little bit of an attitude, make her be this kind of quirky, fun, cute character that would offset some of the darkness in the book. Have her be one of Yaga's companions, and a loyal one at that.
The first chapter ends with the arrival of Tsaritsa Anastasia, who was Ivan the Terrible's first wife, and presumably, I mean, it's believed that he was deeply in love with her, although the evidence for that, as with the evidence of most things in 16th century Russia, is pretty scant. What brings her to Yaga's door? How do they even know each other?
Oh, I should also mention, I forgot to mention one little thing about Little Hen. I actually wrote a short story about how Yaga met Little Hen. And if people sign up for my newsletter through my website, they can actually get the short story for free. So I had a lot of fun with that one. So just a note. So Anastasia comes to Yaga because she has been ill, which at this point in history is quite accurate to the real Anastasia, who was sick for months. With an illness that doctors didn't really know what it was. She is desperate, and while she hasn't seen Yaga for some years, ever since she got married to the Tsar, as of course it would be dangerous for her, you know, to be caught in the wood, a woman alone with a witch, she does value her life more than that, and she recognizes her role in the Tsar's life. And as for Yaga, you know, she's known Anastasia's family for a long time, and she knows Anastasia's mother. Yaga is the one in my story who helped Anastasia get noticed at court. I initially had the idea for this connection because Anastasia was, in reality, chosen out of hundreds of eligible young women at a bridal show. Now, there's a caveat to that. Some sources do say that the priest Sylvester, who was, of course, in my book, one of the disgraced advisors to Ivan the Terrible, in reality, he really was one of his advisors who was disgraced. Some do believe that he suggested Anastasia for Ivan. But aside from all of that, I really did imagine that Anastasia would have a very ambitious mother, as mothers like that tended to be, and that a witch could potentially help her get noticed among all these hundreds of very beautiful young women. So that's how I made that connection.
Despite their friendship and her own loneliness, Yaga initially hesitates to leave her woodland home for Moscow. Why is that?
Well, she's been burned by humanity in the past, even by Anastasia, who, as soon as she became the Tsaritsa, stopped visiting Yaga, stopped talking to her. And Yaga is not sure at the beginning whether she really wants to risk her peaceful existence and, of course, her life as well for the ways of mortals, which is very logical.
It is. What changes her mind?
Well, I think she doesn't want anything bad to happen to Anastasia. Yuga does understand that the Teresa has a calming influence on the Tsar and is beloved by the Russian people. Yuga's the one who saw her potential back when she was a little girl, when her mother and her would visit her hut. And, you know, she knows Anastasia's being poisoned. That is her illness. And aside from Anastasia, weird things are happening in Russia. Winter's creeping into summer. Yuga thinks she imagines a corpse on her hut floor. And when she goes to the underworld, which I call Nav, to get the water of life, she realizes the river with the healing water is frozen. So she wants to find out what is happening because she cares about her homeland, wants to protect her homeland. And honestly, there's a bit of a selfish reason to her changing her mind as well, because she misses people. She misses being around humans because obviously she's half human herself.
This would be a good place to talk a bit about her past and how it intersects with another character, Kashay the Deathless, who is also a character from Russian folklore.
Yeah. So they said, you guys, half goddess. In my book, her mother is the fertility and earth goddess, Makosh. Makosh is the goddess who some scholars believe Baba Yaga is based on or descended from or a version of. In my book, she is Yaga's mother. And Yaga lived with her mother in a regular Russian village, helping people, healing people, before a fire destroyed their home and killed her mother. Then she sort of traveled around the villages, you know, healing people, living among them. But the conversion to Christianity of old Rus around the year 988 by Vladimir the Great really changed all that and changed, you know, how people saw Yuga and her pagan ways. And so she withdrew to the woods. Now, I will note one thing here that's really important is I really try to strike that balance in my book where Yuga is a pagan goddess, of course, but she's very tolerant towards the Christian faith. And you see that in Russia, even today, how spiritualism and superstition lives right along with people's faith. So I didn't want them to have a lot of tension between each other because of that. And so... Anyways, Yuga meets Kashay a few centuries before the book starts. They meet on a battlefield where she often heals dying and wounded men.
And what can you tell us about Kashay himself? What drives him?
Kashay is one of the most challenging characters for me to write. In fairy tales, he is a villain. He is this creepy old man who steals women from their husbands, from their beds, and he imprisons them in his castle. He is also oftentimes Yuga's partner in crime. Sometimes he's her enemy. Other times he is actually her lover, and even sometimes her husband. So they have this connection in the fairy tales, and I wanted to play that up. I wanted him to be in her life, but... I wanted him, like Yuga, to be more relatable and more human for readers today. So in my book, he is largely driven by his fear of death, which does echo in the fairy tale origins as well, because Kashay is known to have hidden his death or his immortality in a very complicated way. So as long as his death or immortality is not found, he can live on and be immortal. Now, the same with my book, and Kashay is willing to do anything to protect himself and survive. But he is quite tortured as well. I wanted him to be a great character. I wanted him to be very complex and have, you know, a lot of things that really go against each other in his nature, because he also loves and respects Yuga, and he loves his homeland. He was a warrior before he became what it is. So I think in the end, I'm very happy with his character. I don't always like him because he's not always a likable character, but I am happy with how he turned out.
Yeah, they really are frenemies. I mean, they're attracted to each other. They have a past, a romantic past, and yet they're clearly on opposite trajectories.
Yes, and I wanted, it was really important for me to, for Yagah to be a strong female without him, because actually, initially, he was supposed to be the love interest. But this is one of the cases where it's the first time this has happened to me, that a character just kind of, as I was writing, made her own decisions, and she really didn't want to stay with him, you know, after all the bad stuff that he did. You know, she has such a important sense of right, an important sense of fighting for what's right, that I didn't want her to be with someone like Kashay, but they can still be fun frenemies, as you said.
It's wonderful when a character does that. It's really hard to explain to non-authors how a character can just refuse to do something. Like, I'm sorry, but that's not my plot. No.
It's the magic of the writing process.
There really is. So when Yagah does eventually get to Moscow, she is initially well received by Tsar Ivan, who is not yet the terrible, we should note. How does that happen?
Well, as we talked about earlier, Ivan the Terrible actually, in reality, did invite a bunch of, call them, magical people to his court, you know, from fortune tellers to magicians to astrologers to sorcerers, you name it. So it would not have been odd for the real Ivan to have invited someone like Yagah to his court, and especially if it made his wife happy. For, as you mentioned, we know from history, he had a very soft spot for his first wife.
And actually, I'm not sure if this came up in your research, but his mother invited Sami shamans to the court because she was married in 26. He wasn't born until 1930. So there was a big pressure on her to produce a child, and she did not immediately. And that was one of her solutions, was to invite these sorcerers to say spells so that she would conceive.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and in fact, shamanism inspired Yagah's magic for me, because it really does have to do with the earth, with spiritualism, with kind of this ancient Russia that that I had in my mind. So yeah, definitely.
Ivan Saras on Yagah pretty fast. Tell us how that comes about and what follows as a result.
Well, I don't want to ruin too much as it is a spoiler, but it comes about from plotting of others at court, and these stories tend to go, right? Seeking to convince Ivan that Yagah does not have an interest in mind. But historically, Ivan was also, as I mentioned, an extremely paranoid man. He would be friends with someone, even be related to them, and yet he would find a way to accuse them of treason, plotting to steal his crown or throne or poison him and or his wife. He was a lot, I see so many parallels with England's Henry VIII in that way, and his numerous marriages.
So, yes, we don't want to give away too many spoilers. So let's switch our interest now to the question of Slavic pagan beliefs. A lot of the background to the novel depends on what we know or suspect about those beliefs. Makosh, we already mentioned, Perun, who was the god of thunder, Volos was the god of camel, and there are various other deities who all appear in the novel. So what kind of research did you do, and how did you reimagine these ancient gods and goddesses for your story?
Well, unlike the example of Greek or Roman mythology, for example, we don't have any texts on Slavic pagan mythology, myth, or gods. I basically learned what I could from various scholars, surmising what those gods could have looked like after a comparative analysis of other pagan religions throughout the world. The gods in my novel, which of course had to be there because the gods have pagan goddess herself, are very much inspired by what we think these gods could have been like, and their stories, of course. But I added a lot of my own imagination into their creation. This took a lot of puzzle. It was a bit of like a puzzle piece, putting together puzzle pieces with what they could have looked like, and just adding a lot of my own as well.
Is one goddess, I don't even know how to pronounce her name, Selica?
Selica, yeah. Sayika as well, if you want the Russian.
Okay, so I hadn't heard of her before. She's not your invention then. She is in the mythology?
Yeah, she is. I mean, that's what's really confusing about the Slavic gods is there are numerous different types of goddesses, of gods. You know, there are the main ones. For example, Perun is always the god of thunder. Volos is always the god of the underworld. But there are some goddesses that are a little less obvious, and she's one of them. She is known to be a death goddess, and she's Kastelika, actually. She's sometimes called Manzana or Marzana. She has different names depending on which country which Slavic country you look at, because she is in various, and in not just in Russia, like a lot of these goddesses and gods. But she actually was oftentimes the representation of the death of winter and the coming alive of spring. So, Slavs would, and actually these festivals still exist in some areas of the Slavic world where the likeness of the goddess is burned and then put in the water, put in the river. For a kind of symbolic coming of spring. So I use that to make her, you know, the death goddess. And sometimes she is the death goddess, actually. So she just kind of changes, like what she is changes from myth to myth and, you know, from scholar to scholar that I've read about her. I wanted a very strong female, not just Ivan. But I wanted a strong immortal female to be Yagat's opponent, and she fit really well into that plan.
So one of the things that interested me when I was reading it is that although there are mortals and there are immortals, and then there's Yaga, who's sort of halfway and halfway, even the immortals can die or be subject to some kind of captivity, which is, I guess, death from their viewpoint. Is that, am I getting that right?
Yeah, exactly. I didn't want to make it too easy for immortals. and because we see that in a lot of, adaptations now. Take Neil Gaiman's American Gods. There too, gods can die. And as we can see this in reality with the Slavic gods, in Russia, a lot of Russians don't know about these pagan gods. When I told my parents about my book, they were like, who is that? And so that's just unbelievable to me how many haven't even heard of these pagan gods that preceded the Christian tradition. So that's just a real life example of how gods can die. They can die because they're not remembered anymore. And that's exactly what happened to my immortal peer.
That seems very fitting for a social media world, doesn't it? A kind of social death because you've been forgotten. Are there any other characters or plot points you'd like to discuss? I don't want to ask you too many leading questions.
Well, I think we could talk about Ivanovka, who is Ivan's son. And the reason is I do think that Ivanovka is one of the people, one of the mortals, that really forces Yaga into the fight. It's what makes it impossible for her to leave. And Ivanovka is the beloved son of Anastasia, of course. And I'm not going to go into too much detail of what happened, but I can talk a little bit about who he's based on. He's based on Ivan's real older son, Tsarevich Ivan, who was Tsar Ivan and Anastasia's firstborn son, who actually lived. And he was the prince, the heir. He was groomed to become the Tsar after Ivan. And again, I'm not going to go into too many details, but I think what was most fascinating about him and what inspired his character is that he did participate in his father's acts of terror against the people. However, he showed more of a mercy, more of knowledge, and also sympathy for the people and for the land and the cities. And he showed a lot of bravery, too. And so I wanted a character like that, that would, you know, have the strength to go against his father fight his father's autocracy from the inside. And to that end, one of my favorite characters of the novel is Vasily. He is, I'm not going to give too much out as well, but he is another character that really inspires Yaga to fight for these mortals, fight for her homeland. And Vasily is a made-up character, but I imagined him to be the son of one of Ivan's other disgraced advisors, called Alexei Andasha. And who was known to be a very caring about people when he was in power. And he also was known to take care of people at the end of his life. Poor people would come into his home. So I have a scene in the novel that has that. It's very much inspired by his character. And so I really wanted a very strong male character that was the opposite of Ivan, and even in some ways the opposite of Ivanushka, who had a weak spot for his father. I wanted Vasily to be the quintessential warrior, the romantic hero that fights for what's right, fights for against autocracy and oppression, and fights for the people, for the regular people of Russia. And so, and again, he and Ivanushka were both very important people for Yaga, as she learns to lean into her humanity and find power in it throughout the book.
What would you like people to take away from The Witch and the Tsar?
I think the biggest thing I'd love people to take away is not everything is as it seems. That there are different ways of approaching and interpreting a villain and a character from mythology and fairy tales. My interpretation does not seek to erase or replace the Baba Yaga from the fairy tales we all know and love. It just seeks to put forth an interpretation that maybe people haven't thought of, or maybe they don't know these origins, or maybe they're still simply uncomfortable with a strong, powerful, young-looking woman instead of a hag taking on this this villain. So I would love for people to be open-minded. I think the second thing that I would love for people to take away is the book also shows a very difficult and cataclysmic time in Russian history with the reign of Ivan the Terrible. His terror against the oppression of his people and the fight against him and his autocracy from the inside. Such stories, I think, are vital, especially now with Russia's war in Ukraine. And this is just my very small, very modest, very fantastical contribution to that genre and of learning about Russia's past.
This book actually came out a year ago. We're recording to coincide with the release of the paperback edition, which has the most gorgeous cover, really. Much nicer than the original one. But I'm sure you're still writing. What are you working on now?
So right now I am revising my second novel with Ace. It is a historical gothic horror tale set in post-revolutionary Moscow, following, of course, the Russian Revolution. It's a gentleman in Moscow meets the hacienda. And the pitch is basically two noble sisters risk all to save each other and their family from their ancestral house, which is bent on bringing back a past, not only dead, but dangerous to remember in post-revolutionary Soviet Russia.
That sounds great. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to our podcast. Once again, I am C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, podcast channel on the New Books Network. And today I've been talking with Alyosha Salnikova-Gilmore about The Witch and the Tsar. Find out more about her at alyoshagilmore.com. Keep up with our news by liking or following New Books Network on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. You can find out more about me and my books at cplesley.com, where I upload expanded posts about the interviews and in general discuss history, historical fiction, and the rapidly changing publishing industry. Goodbye until my next conversation about historical fiction on the New Books Network. Thank you.